a sudden sun discloses, for the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses.
As from WPFW in Washington, D.C., this is the Labor Heritage Power Hour. I'm Chris Garlock. Elise Bryant is away this week.
We gather today to honor 600 crab pickers in 1938 who went on strike to remember the struggle of those crab pickers, the vigilante violence, the racist mobs, and the food shortage which caused harm to families in Chrisville.
There will be this mural, approximately 30 feet wide, that will feature Ben Fletcher, but also not exclusively Ben Fletcher, but also there'll be many other images and sort of people represented to remember Local 8 and the IWW as being really part of the great history of Philadelphia as being radically anti-racist, despite what also is well known, which is that Philadelphia has a long history of and notorious for being a racist city.
And during that 10-day strike, I figured out my role a little bit. I thought I was an organizer because I love to plan and organize and get people together. During that time, those 10 days, I figured out that I was actually more of an agitator. And I was able to use my music and my poetry and my creativity to get other people as excited and passionate and worked up as I was.
Before last Friday, to know about the crab pickers' strike in Chrisfield, Maryland, you had to know about it. This is the story of so many worker struggles in this country. Hard-fought fights that, unlike other battles, the Civil War, for example, have virtually no monuments, no plaques, no visitor centers. But now, on Chrisfield Highway, Maryland Route 413, there's an official state historical marker. It commemorates the 1938 strike by 600 crab pickers, mostly black women. Last Friday, I drove down to Chrisfield for the unveiling of the marker, and I'll share my audio postcard. This Saturday, there will be another unveiling, this one in Philadelphia, of a new mural celebrating Ben Fletcher, one of the most influential working-class unionists, revolutionaries, and organizers in all of U.S. history. We'll talk with historian Peter Cole, author of Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly, whose work inspired the mural. Our story behind the song feature returns today with Emily Jo Tanzi, one of our Great Labor Arts Exchange Song Contest winners last year. Today, she'll tell us the story behind her song, Solidarity is the Only Thing We Need. And on Labor History in 2.
The year was 1913. That was the day Philadelphia longshoremen walked off the job.
That's all coming up on the Labor Heritage Power Hour. But first, we need you to take a moment to call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 and pledge your support during WPFW's Spring Pledge Drive. Our goal this hour is $600. That's just four new members and a $400 contribution. So give us a call now at 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 or go online at WPFWFM.org. You know, we talk on this show about how the Labor Heritage Power Hour is the art and soul of the labor movement, and that reminds me of Rose Schneiderman. Rose organized women working in New York City sweatshops just over 100 years ago. The work was hard, the pay was low, and the working conditions were awful. The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire in 1911, when 146 garment workers were burned alive or died jumping from the ninth floor of a factory building, dramatized the conditions that Rose and the union movement were fighting. Here's one of Rose's famous quotes. The worker must have bread, but she must have roses, too. So I guess what I'm saying is we'll bring you the roses here on the Labor Heritage Power Hour, but we need you to provide the bread so that WPFW is here for us all. Our goal this hour is $600. Let's see if we can't do even better than that. Give us a call now, 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739, or give online at WPFWFM.org. Thanks so much. Here's the show. That's the sound of blue crab being picked by hand out of its shell. Crab pickers can do it in about 20 seconds. It's hard, messy, repetitive work. But back in the 1930s, it literally put food on the table for hundreds of workers, mostly black women, who were the backbone of the local economy on Maryland's eastern shore. But when packing house owners in 1938 cut pay rates to a nickel per gallon of crab meat, the workers rebelled and walked out on strike, not just to protest the pay cut, but to win a union. They were out for 5 weeks, and they won. Last Friday, an official Maryland State Historical Marker was unveiled to honor and commemorate that strike. I drove down to Crisfield, and here's my audio postcard.
Good afternoon. I am Reverend Emmanuel Johnson, pastor of Shiloh United Methodist Church. We welcome you all here on this breezy May afternoon, but we're grateful. This has been a long time coming. Let me read for you from Deuteronomy 24. Do not take advantage of the poor or the needy workers, whether our fellow Israelites or immigrants who live in your land or your cities. Pay them their salary the same day before the sun sets, because they are poor and their very lives depend on that pay, so that they don't cry out against you to the Lord. That would make you guilty. This is one of the passages that the holy pickers read when we gather together each month for our monthly dinner, as we remember those women who stood bravely to say no. And today we've come to commemorate their efforts to stand up to the powers to be.
I'm Elijah McGuire Burke, here as a representative of the Holy Pickers Union Center. We are a prayerful community of seafood workers, gig workers, and their families who gather for prayer meetings, monthly dinners, and to take action on poverty in the community. Today, we are here to formally mark for now and eternity the proud history of our local crab pickers, brave folks who knew in their hearts and minds that anyone who makes Crisfield the seafood capital of Maryland, which is itself the seafood capital of the nation, deserves to be able to raise their families on the sweat of their brow.
We gather today to honor 600 crab pickers in 1938 who went on strike to stand against a pay cut that was exploitative. We gather today to remember the struggle of those crab pickers, the vigilante violence, the racist mobs, and the food shortage which caused harm to families in Crisfield. We gather today to remember the way the church became a refuge for the striking workers, housing union meetings, and holding dinners to celebrate a church that is with the people, not just for the people. We gather today to celebrate the seafood workers of today. We know that the industry is a shadow of its former self, and that many seafood workers have to work side jobs to make ends meet. Amen. We'll now have our historical statement for Reverend Dr. Doretha Whittington.
In 1931, the packing houses reduced rates from 35 cents per gallon to 25 cents per gallon, the equivalent of 7 cents to 5 cents per pound of picked crab meat. On September 8, nearly 300 crab pickers quit working and went on strike. The strikers marched from door to door through working class neighborhoods enlisting support. Their ranks bolstered. They marched through downtown Crisfield. In all, between 700 and 800 crab pickers, of whom about 100 were white, from 22 crab picking plants joined the strike. This was a multiracial effort. Labor unrest continued in subsequent years, and there were allegations of intolerable working conditions and of the exploitation of children. On Maryland's eastern shore, unions were scarce, and organized African Americans were almost unheard of. But by 1937, the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, was leading a movement that organized male and female black and white workers into single industrial unions. The first big battle in the packing industry on the shore occurred at the massive Phillips Packing Plant in Cambridge during a strike in 1937. Over 2,000 black and white workers united and waged a vigorous two-week campaign demanding wage hikes and unionization. At one point, a group of several hundred white and black strikers marched on the city jail and freed a black striker. They ultimately lost the strike and did not achieve a union independent of the company, but the effort was well publicized throughout the Eastern Shore. The United Cannery, Agricultural, Packing, and Allied Workers of America that had been active in the Phillips strike began organizing in Crisfield. In November 1937, three organizers of the Cannery Union were run out of Crisfield by a crowd of about 50 whites while trying to organize the oyster shuckers. Despite the intimidation, one of the smaller crab picking houses was organized in 1937. In 1938, pickers' pay was back up to 35 cents per gallon. At that rate, many pickers earned between $1 and $1.50 weekly, although faster pickers could make as much as $5 a week or more. Out of these earnings, workers paid 35 cents weekly for removal of the crab shells they had picked. A reduction back to 25 cents a gallon meant many workers' already meager earnings would be cut by as much as a third. The packing house owners announced the cut on April the 4th, with the exception of Nelson R. Coben's packing house that continued to pay the old rate of 35 cents per gallon. Pickers at every packing house except Coben's walked out on April 6th, and the packing houses shut down. Local stores were pressured to cut off credit to the strikers, but Howard organized a food committee and began raising funds and food for strikers among the CIO unions and churches in Baltimore. The workers, mostly African-American women, held meetings to keep the strike organized and cope with their lack of income at the Shiloh United Methodist Church, this one here, just off Route 413 on North 4th Street at the entrance of the town. As the strike began its third week, Robert W. Nadler, a field examiner for the National Labor Relations Board, arranged a meeting between the packers and Howard. The conference quickly broke up when Howard demanded a contract guaranteeing rates for a definite period. As the strikers held firm, the packing houses, watermen, and farmers combined forces. The watermen who set the lines to catch crabs were nearly all white, and the season was about to start with the packing houses closed. Local farmers feared the cannery union would organize agricultural workers like it was attempting to do in New Jersey. A white crowd estimated at between 100 and 300 gathered near a black section of town on North 4th Street on April 21st. The mob broke into the home of two sisters who were on the strike committee, Eleanor Coburn and Martina Cooper. Mob leaders declared they would ruin Cooper and Howard if they found them, according to the Afro-American newspaper. They broke into at least one other house on the street, but they couldn't find Cooper, Howard, or any of the other strike leaders, whose name they said was Terry Fowler. Unable to find the strike leaders or the CIO organizers, they turned to the Shiloh Church on North 4th Street, where Howard's auto was parked. The mob overturned Howard's car and set fire to it in front of the church. The Associated Press reported the men were said to have been incensed because the organizers had been seen often in the Negro settlement. According to oral history in Crisfield, Howard was hidden in Up Turf, which is another black neighborhood located on Collins Street, about a half mile north of the church. The local strike leaders stayed at home during the day, but took refuge with friends at night. And unable to find any of the organizers or the strike leaders, members of the mob threatened to burn the whole block, according to the Afro-American. Vigilantes began stopping all cars coming into Crisfield and demanding the occupants state their business. Howard had collected 1,000 pounds of food to distribute, but was prohibited by town or fifth authorities from moving it in, according to the Afro-American. Dahl asked Governor Nice to provide an escort for the food, but Nice stalled for time. The Afro wrote, "Crab pickers, who have openly defied all constituted authority, together with local officers and leaders, have resorted to the tactics of starving the striking crab pickers out in order to force them back to work." Throughout the strike, the women had not engaged in picketing and had instead organized quietly out of the public view. Five smaller packing houses opened back up with the start of the crabbing season by May 2nd, one paying the old rate of 35 cents and the other four paying the reduced rate, in addition to the N.R. Coben house that had operated continuously since the strike began. This first chink in the strikers' armor now put some pressure on the strikers, although the large packing houses remained closed. Perhaps coincidentally with the reopening of some of the packing houses, 12 extra state troopers began appearing in Crisfield, assigned by Munshauer to keep order in the town. In any event, Noe Rasswar reported of those involved in illegal activities designated and designed to intimidate the striking women. On May 3rd, the striking women made their next move. Three of the striking crab pickers, along with Howard, traveled to Washington. There, Senator Bob La Follette promised careful consideration of their requests for an investigation after hearing of the deplorable work conditions and the violence directed toward the strike organizers and leaders. The women, whose identities were closely guarded, also met with Maryland's two senators, the Labor Department and federal conciliators. On May 9th, most of the large packers broke ranks and gave in. Meeting at the Cambridge House of Marine, representatives of eight packing houses and Howard agreed to the terms of the contract. The agreement was signed May 10th to restore the rate to 35 cents a gallon and to recognize the CIO Cannery Union as the bargaining agent for the workers. Howard, whose auto had been burned and who had been run out of town more than once, signed for the union. Tolls, who once said in 1931 that he would close the plant rather than accede to strikers' demands, was also a signatory. The N.R. Carson Company, which had led the drive to reduce the rates, was another signer. In all, the agreement signed by eight packing houses covered well over half of the crab meat pickers in Crisfield. It was among the first large seafood worker contracts on the East Coast. On this day, May 10th, 2024, we celebrate the 86th anniversary of this strike, ending with crab pickers being given a fair wage. To God be the glory.
Thank you, Dr. Whittington. You know, today, we are blessed to have present with us some of those crab pickers who made a few extra dollars because their fingers could move quick. One of them sitting here, right beside me, is a world champion crab picker. Miss Hazel Cropper, take a stand, Miss Hazel. The other is a founding member of Holy Pickers Union Center, and that is Miss Joyce Fitchett. Stand, Miss Joyce. We are grateful for these two women and the work they continue to do in our community. Miss Cropper, her depiction is on the seafood mural right around the corner. And we're just proud of all of our seafood workers here in our community.
After the unveiling, I had a chance to chat briefly with both Hazel Cropper and Margot Green Gale, octogenarians now, who were crab pickers themselves who learned from some of the women who struck back in 1938.
My name is Hazel Cropper. I'm known as Hurricane Hazel because of my gift and speed in picking crab. I had two world records. My first one was 4 pounds, 9 ounces in 15 minutes. And my second one is 5 pounds, .58.
So what does it mean to you to have this actually here now? What?
This memorial thing is greatness, because our forefathers and mothers, they struggled and they worked on just 35 cents a gallon.
Margot Green Gale.
What does it mean to you to have an actual sign like this? It's up here for everybody to see.
It means a lot to me because it shows that somebody a long way appreciated what was done, because the strikes and things that they went through that prepared the way for somebody else. So others were able to continue to work and not go through what these ladies went through. And it just got to the point where they were being taken advantage of. They weren't getting paid what they were worth and that type of thing. And then they decided to strike, and that strike just paved the way for them to make an honest day's living.
Crab pickers Hazel Cropper and Margot Green Gale at the May 10th unveiling of the Maryland State Historical Road Marker commemorating the 1938 strike by 600 crab pickers. For a link to a minute-long video of Hurricane Hazel at work, plus photos of the marker dedication and of the seafood mural featuring the crab pickers, go to laborheritage.org. You're listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. We're in our spring pledge drive this week, and our goal this hour is $600. That's just 4 new members and a $400 contribution. So give us a call now, 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739, or you can go online, wpfwfm.org. Please be as generous as you can. A $250 pledge is just $5 a week, a terrific investment in the station that is of, by, and for you, the people. Give us a call now, 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739, or again, pledge online, wpfwfm.org.
Hello, powerful people. This is Seth Harris from the Power at Work blog. We're proud to be a part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. It has more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org. That's all one word, laborradionetwork.org. Thanks.
This Saturday, May 18th, there will be another unveiling, this one in Philadelphia, of a brand new mural celebrating Ben Fletcher, one of the most influential working class unionists, revolutionaries, and organizers in all of U.S. history. Next up, we talk with historian Peter Cole, author of Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly, whose work inspired the new mural. I thought it would be good to start with just reminding people of who Ben Fletcher was.
Of course. Yeah, so Ben Fletcher is an African-American born and raised in Philadelphia, born in 1890. And as a young man, he became radicalized and joined both the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, and the Socialist Party of America, although dropped out of the latter, and became a labor organizer and a labor leader in the IWW. And the IWW was a revolutionary union in the early 20th century that was founded in order to basically, well, one, sort of organize workers that the mainstream unions generally chose not to, often workers of color, women, and immigrants, but also lesser skilled workers, so-called. But also sort of was explicitly a socialist organization that wanted to build a new society inside of the ashes of the old, as they said. So Ben Fletcher, in his early 20s, helped organize dock workers in Philadelphia, which at that time was the third biggest city in the country in population and maybe the fifth busiest port in the country on the Delaware River. And roughly 4,000 workers went on strike in 1913. These workers were approximately one-third Irish and Irish-American, one-third African-American, and one-third other European immigrants, and won that recognition strike. Were chartered by the IWW as Local 8 of the Marine Transport Workers, and then for the next almost 10 years represented those workers in what probably was the most racially and ethnically integrated union in the United States in that era, or maybe up until that time, and at least until the 1930s, and improved their conditions, but also sort of immediately desegregated the workplace. And so they basically from below pushed employers to integrate work gangs. And Ben Fletcher, who at that time was a Black leader of a white majority union, and became really the most important African-American ever in the IWW, whose members are nicknamed Wobblies, right? And Fletcher, like many other leaders in the Wobblies, were persecuted during World War I, and so were part of a mass trial in Chicago in 1918, sentenced to long prison sentences for treason or, for espionage and sedition in 1918, and so served time in Leavenworth, upwards of 4 years. By late 1922, Local 8 had been broken by the employers, but really Local 8 of the IWW was also the longest term, most durable branch of the IWW, in addition to the fact that it was the most radically integrated. The IWW was very much committed to organizing workers regardless of their race, sex, or nationality. That's some of Ben Fletcher's life. He moved to New York around 1930, died at the young age of 59 in 1949, buried in an unmarked grave in Brooklyn, New York.
May 18th, there will be a mural about Ben Fletcher dedicated in Philadelphia. I'd like you to talk about how that came to be, because you've written a book on Ben Fletcher, but now there's going to be a mural about him.
Let me just say how excited I am with the idea that my dissertation, which became my first book called Wobblies on the Waterfront, and then birthed the second book called Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly, was found by people in Philadelphia, as I had hoped and dreamed for many years. So a group of people in the aftermath of George Floyd's killings, right, in the Democratic Socialists of America's Philadelphia branch, their racial justice committee started to do some research and reading and found me. And then over the last couple of years, working with DSA Philly, but also the IWW branch in Philadelphia, we applied for a mural through the city's mural arts program, which is very well known across the country for being one of the best city-driven mural programs. They finance the murals. They help identify and select the artists. They help identify and clear the legal work with the building owners. This building actually happens to be a city-owned building. And the artist that will be doing the work is Jonathan Pinkett, or who has done the work. He's a African-American, born and raised and lived in Philadelphia, painter who designed the mural, and then muralists who are expert muralists helped turn the design into the actual mural. A community paint day occurred about a month ago in which upwards of 75 people contributed to the painting, and the painting is done offsite per the mural arts program. And then in the next few weeks, the mural will be installed on site very close to the Delaware River, which is the east side of the city of Philadelphia, and was the working port side of the city. Now that is really sort of changed because of the construction of I-95 50 years ago. 301 South Columbus Boulevard, just south of the Maritime Museum in the city, the Independent Seaport Museum, there will be this mural, approximately 30 feet wide, that will feature Ben Fletcher, but also not exclusively Ben Fletcher, but also there'll be many other images and sort of people represented to sort of remember Local 8 and the IWW as being really sort of part of the great history of Philadelphia as being radically anti-racist, despite what also is well known, which is that Philadelphia has a long history of and notorious for being a racist city. The bombing of the MOVE houses in West Philly in the mid-80s, the arrest and sort of persecution of Mumia Abu-Jamal, right? But going back to the 1890s, W.E. Du Bois' first book, sometimes considered the first book of sociology ever in the United States, was called The Philadelphia Negro, in which he documented the long history of racism in the late 19th century that African Americans. Simultaneously, it's also been a place of refuge for Black people, right? Going back to the colonial era, and it at that time had the largest Black population outside of the South, although that was subsequently surpassed by New York City and Chicago and some other places, right? And so Philadelphia is a fascinating place with both sort of horrible and wonderful history. So this mural will represent, and will for probably anyone who sees it, introduce them for the first time to this history.
So since we're on radio, can you draw us a bit of a picture, a verbal picture of what the mural depicts?
Of course. So I love murals in public art. This one's interesting because the wall is not a sort of rectangle. It is rectangular in shape, but there's a sort of a large garage doorway. It's a city-owned building that's a working city building for like, say, logistics and whatnot. So there's sort of like a left and a right side, if you will. And then not quite in the middle is this entryway, right? So on one side is an image of Ben Fletcher who taken from his, the photograph that when he was processed at Leavenworth at the federal pen in 1918. So it's sort of like a image of Fletcher, just his torso and head, right? But then also the artist Jonathan Pinkett used some of the classic iconography of the IWW, for example, the IWW symbol, a circular symbol with their three initials and stars, as well as one of the symbols that is often associated with the IWW, which is a black cat, right? So the Sab Cat, taken from an artist named Ralph Chaplin, who also was a songwriter and a poet, but who is best known for his song Solidarity Forever, which is the AFL-CIO motto song, but was originally created by Chaplin, who at that time was a wobbly, right? On the other side is sort of more of a images of a groups of people, men and women, right? Black and white, who are part of an action. Maybe it's a march, maybe it's a protest, maybe it's a strike, in multicolors, right? Actually blues and reds and black. It doesn't yet exist in purpose, although I've seen images of it, right? And so I myself haven't seen it. And what will be flying out for the event, like you said, on Saturday, May 18th.
Talk a little bit about the process of sort of visualizing something as complicated as Ben Fletcher, right? I mean, I've read your book. So to turn that into, you know, supersized art, how does that happen?
Yeah, well, I love art, but I'm not an artist, as I've been told more than once. Jonathan Pinkett actually is interesting because he's an African-American artist who's trained in sort of classical European painting, which means like oil portraits. But like with some other Black artists, is sort of then usually his subjects are Black, right, who generally have been left out of the traditional canon, right? So Pinkett was the one who sort of worked with us, read some of the work that I had written, but also we talked with and texted each other, right? And then he decided to create basically an He literally did an oil painting as his style, right? Like of Fletcher based on that photograph, right? But then started to add other features in, right? Based on his creativity, but also skill. And then of course shared it with members of both Mural Arts as well as the sort of the core group who was the people who applied officially, right, to the Mural Arts program.
Talk a little bit about the role of this kind of public art.
You know, in the last 5 or 6 years, I've just become very committed to it. I also have come to now teach public history courses at my university, without any formal training, but sort of as a practitioner, but also as a true believer, right? And I think it's just so wonderful. So public art, by definition, is art in the public space, as opposed to in your own home or in a museum or a sort of a business or a school building, right? And so like public art is intended to reach people who aren't necessarily looking for it, right? And of course, public art has many different purposes, and one might simply be to sort of beautify, right? As well as to sort of enhance, right? Sort of a community. And that's awesome, right? Like, but some public art also has additional layers of meaning, right? Like intentional by the artists, to sort of do something more than that. And that includes education and sometimes provocation, I'd say, right? In some sort of modest way, right? Like, so you're walking down the street, you see this amazing mural. What is it? Well, it's a form of education, right? Like, because the great majority of humans, especially adults, aren't in school, right? And so how do they learn? Well, we can actually facilitate that by creating opportunities, right? Now, some people will seek out this work because they know something about the subject. But most people who see public art just happen by in their ordinary daily routines and lives. Of course, also tourists to, or visitors to a place also might sort of learn or come across those things. But really, the genius, I think, of public art is that it reaches people who aren't looking for it, right? It sort of improves, we hope, but also, like I said, beautifies, but in some cases, educates, right? And so this one, for example, there'll be like some small text, but also QR codes so that someone who wishes can use their smartphone and sort of learn a bit more about that subject, right? And so, you know, it's obviously growing in many places, right? And I've actually heard some critiques who say that murals are sort of just some sort of early phase of gentrification, right? Like I bristle against that a bit, although I understand that they might not be what a community needs first. A community needs first, say, food and shelter and you know, decent lives. But like art is really sort of essential. That's why really literally 30,000 years ago, people were creating art according to the first cave paintings that we have. Why would people have done that, right? There was no sort of material benefit. It was solely because those people were creative and wanted to basically share themselves and their ideas with people who lived later. Right. It's really amazing to think about that it's part of this tradition that goes back to the late Ice Age.
Your call. Congratulations, and thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today. And I look forward to seeing you in Philly on the 18th.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and Labor Heritage.
Peter Cole, author of Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly, whose work inspired a new mural that'll be dedicated this Saturday, May 18th, 2 p.m. at 301 South Christopher Columbus Boulevard in Philadelphia. Details are at laborheritage.org. Our story behind the song feature returns today with Emily Jo Tanzi, one of our great Labor Arts Exchange Song Contest winners last year. Today, she'll tell us the story behind her song, Solidarity is the Only Thing We Need. Before we get to Emily, a quick reminder to take a moment to call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 and pledge your support during WPFW's Spring Pledge Drive. Our goal this hour is $600. We're providing the roses here on the Labor Heritage Power Hour, and we need you to provide the bread. Give us a call now, 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. Of course, you can go online, wpfwfm.org. show that you appreciate and value the Labor Heritage Power Hour and WPFW. Give us a call, 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739, or online, WPFWFM.org. Thanks so much. Here's Emily.
Justice and equality for all. When you stand in your ground, oh, just listen for the call. We'll tear it down, we'll tear it down together. Because solidarity, it's the only thing we'll ever really need. Standing right beside you, we'll set our people free and build a whole new world together.
Hi, I'm Emily Jo Tansey, and I perform under the name Emmy of the Mountains. I am an activist, a teacher, and musician, and I live in Morgantown, West Virginia. And I was born in West Virginia, and I'm Appalachian through and through. The word solidarity, I thought I knew what that meant in like a theoretical sort of way. It means to stand together. It means to support each other. But I really didn't understand the weight of that word until 2018, when I went on strike with my fellow educators here in West Virginia. And during that 10-day strike, I figured out my role a little bit. I thought I was an organizer because I love to plan and organize and get people together. I definitely saw myself as an educator because that's what I do. That's my passion. But during that time, those 10 days, I figured out that I was actually more of an agitator. And I was able to use my music and my poetry and my creativity to get other people as excited and passionate and worked up as I was. And so working together with my fellow teachers and all the people that were supporting us, I was able to really understand and embody that word of solidarity. So that's kind of where the birth of this song comes from, that experience I had in 2018. And then we also went on strike in 2019. It was a little bit shorter, just for a couple days that time. But the foundation was already laid. We already knew how to organize. We knew how to do this. And that's when I really started to use my music in a different sort of way. So leading myself a little bit further on, I still hadn't written this song yet. It was still probably just percolating somewhere in my brain. But in the summer of 2020 was just a huge summer for all of us in America. That's when the Black Lives Matter protests were happening. It's when we were scared about what the future was going to look like because of COVID. And leading into the fall of that year is actually when I wrote the song. My friend and I, Julia, she and I have been on strike together. We have gone to women's marches together, protests together, climate protests together, all kinds of things. And we were just feeling really burned out. So Julia said, hey, let's go on a hike. Let's go immerse ourselves in the nature of West Virginia and remind ourselves of why we're doing this, why we're fighting so hard for a place that doesn't seem like it wants us to be here, and really just reminding ourselves of our purpose. So we took this hike on this beautiful autumn day through Blackwater Falls, which is a state park in West Virginia. It's absolutely gorgeous, so please go there. And I started thinking about the song and about how the only way we can curtail the burnout, the only way we can fight back against all of these forces that are trying to stop us from using our voices is with each other. And so that is where solidarity is the only thing we need. That's where that came. It's from that hike. And that's why it kind of opens with that line about may your heart burn as bright as the maple leaves in fall.
May your heart burn as bright as the maple leaves in fall. When you're fighting for justice and equality for all,
When you stand in your ground, oh, just listen for the call. We'll tear it down, we'll tear it down together. Because solidarity, it's the only thing we'll ever really need. Standing right beside you, we'll set our people free and build a whole new together.
It's been really well received in a lot of different avenues I've gotten to play it. The most exciting one was getting to perform this at Labor Notes in Chicago during the Great Labor Arts Exchange, which was hosted by the Labor Heritage Foundation, which is where I met so many awesome, amazing, brilliant, talented songwriters and agitators like myself. So that performance just filled me with so much joy. It was just so powerful because at the end of every section where I sing solidarity, the whole crowd was screaming forever. And it felt so good to know that people were hearing those words. And it was really me sharing that message of like, if we're in this together, we can overcome anything. And that's, it was just awesome.
World together. Stars in your eyes never fade away. When you cry out for freedom, prosperity for all, standing right beside you, I'll answer every call. To tear it down, we'll tear it down together. Because solidarity, it's the only thing beside you, will set our people free and build a whole new world together. And may the line that you hold remain strong and true, 'cause the bosses and their cronies, they don't mind what they do. Stop pleading your case, they're not listening to you. You gotta stand up and fight forever. Because solidarity, it's the only thing we'll ever really need. Standing right beside you, we'll set our people free and build a whole new world together. With solidarity, it's the only thing that we ever really need. Standing right beside you, we'll set our people free and build a whole new world together. We'll tear it down, we'll tear it down forever. Gonna make things better.
Emily Jo Tanzi with the story behind her song, Solidarity is the Only Thing We Need. Emily was one of our Great Labor Arts Exchange Song Contest winners last year.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. That was the day Philadelphia longshoremen walked off the job. Led by the industrial workers of the world, the strike was remarkable for its militancy, its industrial unionism, and its interracial organizing. The Wobblies had been fighting to organize workers in the city for years. Unionizing efforts included Amalgamated Local 57, which organized workers across whole industries. Attracted to the IWW's message of interracial unionism, black longshoreman Ben Fletcher joined up readily and soon emerged as an early leader of Local 57 and then Longshoremen's Local 8. In his book, Wobblies on the Waterfront, historian Peter Cole notes the origins of the local started with the striking sugar refinery workers on the banks of the Delaware. Dockers made contact with the IWW during the strike and drew up a list of grievances and demands. And by this day in 1913, 1,500 longshoremen struck for a leveling of the hourly wage for all workers, regardless of skill, shorter hours, and union recognition. They held strike meetings every day and elected a committee of 15 with representatives from every ethnic and racial group. Cole notes this was crucial, given the diversity of the dock's 4,000 workers. More than a third were black, another third were immigrants. The committee included Poles, Jews, blacks, Irish, and others. Strikers took on their employers and also the police. Beatings, intimidation, and arrests of strikers occurred daily and intensified as the ship owners attempted to herd in scabs. 1,200 coal and iron ore handlers joined in on the strike. The port was solidly shut down. And by the end of the month, the shippers were forced to concede to most of the Wobblies' demands. Industrial unionism and interracial solidarity had won the day.
All right, folks, that is just about it for this week's edition of the Labor Heritage Power Hour. But Elise Bryant is back with us. She's back from the road. Elise, you're not only back, but you have your voice back. What happened?
That's right, Chris.
Oh, my goodness, you sound great.
I had a terrible case of laryngitis, and it was the Clue 50th anniversary in Niagara Falls, New York, and I couldn't whisper. I couldn't get out a sound. It was pitiful.
No voice.
I was forced to do what you know you're supposed to do, which is stop, breathe, relax, rest well, and I didn't. So I'm glad to be back, and I'm glad to have my voice back.
So here's what I was thinking, Elise, because, you know, we're in our spring fundraising drive.
Yes.
I thought there's something about losing your voice, and maybe you had a chance to think about it while you were, while you were uncharacteristically quiet. It's very hard for me to imagine. But about, you know, PFW, to me anyway, gives folks a voice. And
absolutely,
there are voices that we bring to PFW, not just on this show, obviously, but let's talk about this show. So I'm trying to explain why it's important for people to contribute. So I'm going to kick it over to you since you've got your voice back.
Because WPFW is the voice of resistance. It's the voice of jazz and justice in a vast wasteland where you're not going to hear this anyplace else. And it feeds the soul in a very specific way that nobody else does. And that's why WPFW is absolutely essential. And our voices on the air to hear that next generation of WPFW broadcasters, hosts who have come up and are coming up with their own sound and their own stories and their music. I'm so grateful. And I'm going to do what I can to support the station. And I hope everybody else there who's listening will do the same. We're the voice of the people.
Voice of the people. Here's how you do it, folks. 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739, wpfwfm.org. You can just click on donate now and give that way. And at least I know one of the things, and I know, you know, for organization is folks making like monthly pledges. And there's two things I was thinking about that. One is like, I did the math. I had to get my little calculator out, but I was like, you know, $250. It seemed like that's like a lot to like write a check for $250 for me anyway. Maybe not for some people, but that's like $5 a week. Is that a week? Yeah, $5 a week.
Okay, you do the math. But whatever it takes, and as we always say, there's no amount too small or too big to keep the voice of the people alive and on the air. So yeah, $250.
All right, folks, 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739, online, wpfwfm.org. Support this show, support this station, support yourself.
That's right, and support the power of the people to have a voice.
All right, should we do the credits now?
Ready. If you've got suggestions for guests or topics for future shows, drop us a note, not a line, at info@laborheritage.org. Drop us a note at info@laborheritage.org.
Our music today included Red and Roses from Judy Collins and Solidarity is the Only Thing We Need by Emily Jo Tanzi.
The Labor Heritage Power Hour is a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org.
Today's show is produced by me, Chris Garlock, and engineered by Mike Nasella and Kalia Chapman here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Thanks so much for listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
The art and soul of the American labor movement.
You betcha.